Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, July 20th. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for the Science Forum on Vox Pop, and we welcome back a panel of brilliant people to answer your scientific inquiries. Give us a call now at 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551, or you may email the program, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Line up. Step right up. Step right up. Get your science questions in. It is the Science Forum. It begins after the news. Well, hello once again, everyone. It's Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's exciting because we reconvene the Science Forum today on the program. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. You may also email us, and we will get to as many as we can. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number here on the Science Forum VoxPop is 800-348-2551. With that said, let's have our scientists sign in, please.
Ed Stander, geology, astronomy, environmental science, anything that anybody else can't answer from SUNY Cobleskill.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist.
And I'm, dead.
Yeah, we'll turn that mic. There you are, number five. You're on.
Can't shut me up. I'm Barbara Provetz. I'm a biochemist from SUNY Cobleskill. Thanks, Zach.
And again, our number is 800-348-2551. Jim Pickett, I understand you have brought a topic to discuss at the outset.
Yes.
It's a sleeper.
It's a sleeper.
What is that?
Well,
Don't lie to us.
Last week's Chemistry and Engineering News, the magazine of the American Chemical Society.
I keep it in my bathroom every day.
Exactly. I do have it in my bathroom.
Yeah. Yes. Open it up, and there's an article about the polyurethane mattress industry.
All right.
Now, back when I was a college kid 100 years ago, there was a slab of polyurethane foam on the bed, and it was pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But then memory foam was developed, and that became kind of high-end mattresses, and now it's becoming extremely popular. And there's a great deal of science behind all of that, and it's really a good example of what industrial scientists, industrial chemists do. Because initially, for the good old-fashioned slabs of polyurethane foam were pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
The memory foam goes in. The way the springiness was controlled was by the way the holes in the foam, the cells, if they're all closed, then it's springy.
Mm-hmm.
If they're fully open, then it just kind of collapses down.
Okay.
So what they did was adjust the holes in the cells so that it would deflate slowly and then kind of reinflate slowly, memory foam.
But there was a trick to it as well, if I could add, and that's that air is a very good insulator. And the less holes they were, the more air got trapped, and therefore you got hotter and hotter on the beds.
Exactly.
And I hate a hot bed.
That's right. So that was solved by increasing the amount of holes in the cells. But you still want it to have this springy control.
Mm-hmm.
That then is controlled by the chemistry. The polyurethane foam is essentially little wiggly, flexible blocks of molecules connected together at kind of hard sites.
Okay.
And you can adjust kind of the springiness of all of this by what you make that middle block out of. So that's been tinkered with to get that just right. So now you can have cells which have lots of holes in to allow air to flow while still having the right kind of spring to have that memory effect.
There's nothing better than a memory foam mattress, I think.
Well, imagine you've done it, Ray. You've taken a box spring mattress home on the top of your car, and there's always been some kind of crisis event where the duct tape gives way and your mattress goes flying down the Northway.
Well, I've never duct taped a box spring to my roof. But
not use the kid's shoelaces
to get it
across the roof.
That's something I would do, but I didn't actually get around to that one yet.
And now you can have the UPS man deliver it.
It's pretty cool.
Like, darn, not another one of these boxes of beds, but they come in a box.
It turns out that that's another variable for customer satisfaction. People want to be able to take it out of the box and have it do its self-inflating thing quickly.
Yeah, sleep on it that night.
Yeah, that because it's all crunched down,
right.
It's memory foam. It takes a while for it to come back.
But not that long, right?
But
first night it's not quite the same as the second night, truly, for a bed in a box.
So for customer satisfaction, that's another variable that the developers have to get the real trick
is if you're tired of it, trying to get it back in the box.
Because a lot of these have these money-back guarantees. Try it for 100 nights, and if you don't like it, ship it back to us on our cost.
Right.
But you got to get it in the box. Good luck.
Put it in an envelope.
No, you just duct tape it to the roof of your car.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. It is the Science Forum, and we start out with Jim in Lanesboro, Massachusetts. Jim, you're first.
Thank you. I was just wondering, like, after you shampoo your hair, you use hair conditioner? What is the hair conditioner doing to make the hair more slippery?
I love this question.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Because otherwise your hair gets tangled.
Right. So the outer coating of your hair, the actual hair shaft, is called the cuticle, just like we have at the bottom of our fingernails. And it's harder than the stuff at the bottom of our fingernails. And in humans, it has a specific repeating pattern, and that's called the imbricate pattern. So you hear the word brick in the middle because it's stacked like a brick pattern on the side of a building. So there's these little sections of kind of fuzzy, like brick itself. If you were to take a piece of cotton and rub it across brick, some of the cotton would stick behind because there's these raised surfaces on a brick. Well, the same is true with the cuticle of human hair. So one of the things that conditioners have in them are conditioners. That's literally what they're called, but they're really mild acids to kind of smooth off and tighten up that fuzziness to the cuticle imbricate pattern. It would not work on a bat, however, because a bat does not have imbricate hair. It has spinous hair, which are really, under the microscope, really cool. It looks like
spines,
like somebody in a punk band. They're sticking out in all directions.
Yeah.
So you'd really, really have to condition your
bat. So this is probably why we don't see a lot of bat hair conditioner out there
I would think that, and I'm probably sure that it would, the spinous nature of bat hair is to help them keep warmth in, because they can trap that air similar to that foam mattress. So
if you use conditioner, your hair gets colder.
Actually, to a certain extent, yeah, but imbricate, it's not as fuzzy as the other types of hair. But Jim, there's like other stuff in hair conditioner too, right? Like polymers, again.
Yeah, there's stuff that I think actually kind of gloms onto the surface of the hair and puts a slippery coating on it.
Oh, very interesting. Well, go ahead, Jim, you want to follow up?
Yeah, well, in the stores now I'm seeing shampoo/conditioner in one.
Mm-hmm.
So is that possible? They can do that?
Yes. What they do is they have a little time release deal. So you get the lather effect, and then you still get the acid wash with the lather. The acid can then wash off your hair. That's fine because you've already tightened up that fuzziness to the imbricate pattern. And then you just get less polymer in there because that can interfere with the lathering.
Thank you, Jim. And, of course, there is also body wash, hair, and conditioner as well.
Oh, my gosh. The 3-in-1.
It's fantastic.
For men, that's like, yes, I can just use one bottle.
Exactly.
You could be out of the shower in 10 seconds.
Yeah.
It's really, really great.
And then yell at everyone else for taking too long.
Science is wonderful. Yeah. Let's go.
But shampoo is not high on my list of priorities.
This is radio, so you don't know what Jim's hair status is.
He has a full head of hair. Edward, you're on. Edward in Loudonville.
I'm here.
Hello, I have a question about radio interference.
Okay.
This is something that's been going on for years. It seems to be a seasonal thing. I'm listening to WAMC or WMHT, and I can move around the room. We're talking about a small portable radio. And at various times of the day and various seasons, it seems to be spring and into fall and or in the evenings, that I can walk around the room and there's interference with the radio. And also in the second floor radios, the same thing happens. Mm-hmm. And yet, at other times of the day or seasons, there is no interference. Do you know what's going on there?
Well, I sure don't know what would cause the seasonal effect.
Well, I think it's probably weaker signal. You have leaves.
Yeah.
And water vapor also absorbs radio waves.
So it's a weaker signal, and so that effect is always there when you're walking around. But because the signal is weaker at that time, you're noticing it.
I can be sitting in a chair. and move my body and get interference and yet move it back, and there's no interference.
That sounds
most
like
most of the time there's no interference at all.
That sounds like a grounding problem. It sounds like your system. Is it plugged into the wall first of all, or is it just battery?
Yes, it's plugged into the wall.
Are you holding it?
No.
Okay.
No.
It's sitting on a refrigerator.
I thought it might be inductance.
Ooh, it's on a refrigerator.
It sounds like heterodyne inductance. Yeah. It's the same sort of thing that I have a musical instrument at home called a theremin. And as you get closer and further away from it, you get different sounds. And it's effectively what's happening is you're becoming a part of the ground loop. And as you get closer, you're changing the impedance of the system by effectively sending it into the ground through your body. So what I would... Oh, go on.
But distance isn't an issue, though, because I can be close or I can be far away. And it also, as I say, it's almost like a seasonal effect also. At certain times of the year, it happens, and other times, nothing happens. Like, it just seems strange.
Does it happen more often when it's humid than when it's not humid?
No, because it can happen in you know, dry weather in the fall, for instance.
Well,
I'm wondering whether it has to do with sunsets or the sun or
I think
solar
as,
effects.
As Ray pointed out, that seasonal changes in the foliage, other things affect the strength of your radio signal. So if you have a weak signal, then changes of the inductance changes around will have a greater effect than when the signal is strong.
And I suppose if the signal's weak enough, him walking around in different spots could multipath the signal as
just
well.
Just enough to push it over. There's an interesting story in the family. We had a Wi-Fi camera back when that wasn't cool to kind of monitor who was in the driveway because we didn't have a doorbell. Why fix the doorbell? We'll just add technology.
Sure.
My parents had two homes, so they would check the camera periodically to see what was going on. And every once in a while, it would be nothing there. It would just be fuzz. We couldn't figure out what was going on until we realized that the refrigerator in the kitchen was creating some kind of heterodyne interference. It was on its way out, like it was dying. And that electrical disruption only happened when the refrigerator came on. So the detectives, us scientists in the family, had to figure out what the common factor was, and it was the darn fridge.
Very cool. We have to take a break here. It's the Science Forum. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, Barbara Robbins, and Ray Graff. You at 800-348-2551. We'll be back.
Support comes from Jane Iredale, a mineral makeup company specializing in makeup that is good for the skin. Jane Iredale retail shop at Louisa Ellis Boutique, Great Barrington. JaneIredale.com. Stavros, helping people with disabilities achieve their dreams, offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield. Stavros.org for more information. The Wild Center, Tupper Lake, New York, presenting Pete M. Wire's iForest, an immersive sound experience. WildCenter.org for details. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org. And Capital Roots, providing the space, know-how, and resources for Capital Region residents to grow their own food in 52 community gardens. CapitalRoots.org for information on how to support.
Vox Pop on WAMC. The Science Forum with Ray Graff, 800-348-2551. Our scientists, Barbara Brabitz, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander. Ed, I didn't realize you had a theremin.
Yeah, I have
Can
two
you bring that
two
in?
Two of them.
Sure. I have two of them.
Next show.
Sure. I've got a theremin from the 1930s that was made by GE.
Yeah.
And I've got one that was made by Bob Moog about 20 years ago.
Oh, that's very neat. And there are two types, right? One is a free one has both amplitude and frequency, right?
Oh, well, they all have effectively pitch and volume.
They do?
Yeah.
Because the one I saw Jimmy Page play.
Oh, well, he doesn't actually use the volume one.
He just sort of
moves it around, right?
Very impressive all
but
the same.
The dogs will have to move away from the radio when he plays the theremin.
Really?
Because they'll howl for sure.
You're kidding me.
Oh, it's there's something primal about the noise of the, I'm sorry, music of a theremin.
thank you, Barbara.
I don't know. Do you think we have dogs listening to this program?
I think we have a great audience.
I can tell you, they don't really pledge. All right, let's go to Bruce in Albany. Bruce, you're on.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the call. I got a question about my red maple in my front yard, and I'm wondering why the leaves are red. What's the evolutionary benefit of that adaptation? I thought leaves were green because it's more efficient for plants to process the red wavelength or the red wavelengths.
So, what? Sure. Evolution really didn't help on that. We did it. But, cultivation and selection.
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It still grows, right?
It does.
For the audience that's out there, the major photosynthetic pigments that are going to be in a typical leaf are chlorophyll A, chlorophyll B, because we're really good at naming these things, and then the carotenoids, beta carotene, alpha carotene, stuff like that. You'll find that there's a lot less chlorophyll A and B and a lot more of the carotenoids, the carotenes in the red leaves, the Japanese maples, the red maples, the ones that have a reddish tinted leaf even when it's not fall. And they can still very efficiently convert. They just absorb and reflect different wavelengths of light. And actually absorb some of the green that the other pigments don't absorb. So in a normal leaf, you have all of them, but you have more of the chlorophyll A's and B's, and so you get that green reflection.
Okay.
So,
that's interesting.
If you were doing agronomy, like if you wanted to grow a really, really good potato, you would not try to pick a leaf that's red, because you're not going to get as good sugar production and conversion into starch. You can buy an ornamental red potato plant, but they're meant to be ornamental because no one cares about the little potato that you're growing in the garden with your flowers. So,
yeah, but I get that. So in nature, doesn't nature strive for the most efficient, is that the sort of the evolutionary, the Darwinian path towards the most efficient solution to a problem?
Nature may do that, but people like different colors.
And even nature, one of the things that I've learned from actually answering things incorrectly on this show, this would have been many, many years ago and never could happen
again.
I've never noticed an incorrect answer on this show.
Correct. Is that some of the higher wavelengths, the blues and the purples, are purposefully not absorbed by the plant because they can disrupt DNA. So even though we think of UV as kind of the disruptive type of light, UV, X-ray, that type of stuff, even in plant DNA, because they're out there all the time, no sunscreen for them, they discard the blues and the purples. It would be more efficient for them to actually absorb the blues and the purples.
Higher energy.
But because it's a higher energy state, you can get more bang for that electron cascade. But they choose not to in a way because they're balancing the DNA disruption versus more energy. So higher efficiency.
There you go.
Yeah. Higher efficiency isn't necessarily where evolution takes us.
Plus the carotenoids are stabilizing molecules. The whole deal of energy kind of production through photosynthesis and then energy usage, like in our mitochondria, is very dangerous stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It generates nasty intermediates.
And, peroxides, for example.
Peroxides, superoxide, hydroxyl radicals, all sorts of nasty things. And that's sort of why those are confined to little organelles, the chloroplasts and the mitochondria. Don't let the rest of the cell middle
get
of this. This is for the pros.
Yep.
And the carotenoids probably evolved to act as stabilizers because they quench some of those high energy things that are made.
Huh. All right, let's go over to Teresa in Stillwater. Teresa, you are on the Science Forum.
Thank you, sir. I have a question about my hummingbird feeder and the level of why it's fluctuates in the level. The feeder is shaped like a hot air balloon with the reservoir on the bottom, and at the neck of it, when you fill it, it'll be a certain level. I can look at it at certain different times of the day, and the level will be down below the reservoir. And I don't think the birds have drank that much, because then it'll come back up maybe if I look at it at early evening or something. Is this something about atmospheric pressure?
Atmospheric pressure, but more likely temperature.
Temperature would move the volume up and down.
Yes, it will.
Oh, yeah.
But where does it go when it goes down? It doesn't come out the opening. That's so funny. You know what I'm saying? Unless it doesn't, I don't see it.
Well, where are the holes that the birds drink from? Are they at the top of the bottom or on the sides of the bottom?
They're on the bottom of the top of the reservoir.
Right. Right, that's why, because you don't have to have it super, super, super full for that hummingbird to get the... So you're getting like a level change in that reservoir. It's a wider reservoir than the neck. The neck is skinny, so what you see is a pronounced change in your perception, but in reality,
it's only a little bit.
Yeah, what you could do is an experiment. Bring it inside, let it equilibrate to room temperature, and then cup it with your hands. To warm it up a bit.
The reservoir or the glass.
Just hold it in your hands and warm it up and see if that changes.
And how long would that take?
It should just take a minute or two.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Unless you have really cold hands.
Teresa, great question. 800-348-2551, the telephone number here on the Science Forum. 800-348-2551. Jory and Delmar, you're on.
Hi there. I have a question about rainbows. I know that if I go outside and see a rainbow, if I ask my wife to come outside and watch it with me, she will see it. And if I get my neighbor to come out, they might see it. But if I call my friend in maybe 10 miles away, they may or may not see it. If I call my daughter out in California, she's not going to see it. What is the range of, you know, how far is it that someone can see the same rainbow that I'm seeing? It's probably not the same rainbow, but at least a rainbow.
Everyone has their own rainbow, right?
Everyone has their own rainbow. And that's going to depend on the extent of the water droplets that are in the air and where the light can get to them. So it could be very localized or it could be pretty widespread.
Yeah, there's two things involved. There's the raindrops themselves and the position of the sun. Mm-hmm. And the sun has to be in the right position for the light to get into the drop and then bounce back and come back towards you. So it's very possible for somebody right nearby you not to be able to see the rainbow, provided that the sun's not in the right place.
Right, if their back isn't in the same orientation as yours to the sun. But curvature of the Earth is about 15 miles or so. So I think at the max, the rainbow's above the curvature of the Earth, but you know, the maximum range you could see a rainbow? What's your guess, Ed?
I have no idea.
That's a good question.
Probably like 30-40 miles is my guess.
Well, yeah. But since
someone who up in Burlington may not be able to see the same rainbow as me.
Well,
or at least a rainbow at the same time.
An important point is that there's not really anything there that's the rainbow. What there is water droplets suspended in the air and then the light getting refracted around so that you can see it. So technically, someone standing right next to you sees a different rainbow. You're not looking at it because it's a virtual thing. It's not something that's really there. So it being able to see a rainbow is going to just be dependent on how widespread the phenomenon is of the bright droplets in the air
and the position of the sun.
All right, Jory, good question. Thanks a lot. 800-348-2551, the phone number. Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, and Barbara Brabets are the panel today. And you can call at 800-348-2551. Richard in Schenectady. You're on, Richard.
Yes, good afternoon, all. I remember hearing a few months ago over a program on the television that it said that temperature in the North Pole was 35 degrees warmer than either last year or the average of the previous few years. And I'm thinking that's an increase that's not typical for the rest of the world, and considering that there are a lot of people who want the ice in the Arctic Ocean to melt as fast as possible for shipping routes to be able to go through there and to mine the surface of the ocean, I'm wondering if there's something that humans are doing that are, that's contributing to that. It would make sense more than mere coincidence.
Well,
I'm wondering what that could be. I mean, I can imagine what it would be if it were being done below the surface of the ocean, but I don't think they do that. Is there anything they might be doing above the surface of the ocean?
Well, there are really two things that control the weather around the North Pole, and both of them have to do with the ice. If there's ice at the North Pole or ice in the North Pole Basin, then first of all, you have a much higher albedo, which means you have much more reflection of sunlight off, and as a result, things stay much colder than they would be normally. That's the first thing. As the ice melts, the water takes in a lot more, because it's much darker, takes a lot more of the heat, and as a result, heat gets trapped. The second thing is that the North Pole normally is a high, effectively. That is to say that the weather is always exactly the same at the North Pole. And the reason for that is that when there's ice on the water, there's effectively nothing to cause a major change in temperature. So it stays relatively constant. If you get rid of the ice, if you start decreasing the amount of ice, then you have areas that are warmer and areas that are colder. And as a result, that heat starts to spread around. So the reason for the ice melting up there, of course, is probably at least in part due to global warming caused by people. It could also be caused by changes in solar radiation. But what's important is that if the ice is there, everything's stable. But as soon as the ice starts going, then temperatures start to change.
Is it as much as 35 degrees? Did anybody else hear that?
There's a compounding effect for the last two winters anyway, and that's the El Nino and the La Nina.
Right.
So we have two weather phenomena that are somewhat predictable that did happen two winters ago. And we had the El Nino, which is a shift in the currents. That really affects more at the Arctic Circle than it does at the North Pole. But, for example, the Bering Strait and the Bering Sea were the warmest some winters in a row that they've had in 100 years. But the El Nino effect also impacted our winter here in New York State. We didn't have much snow 2 years ago. And this past year, we didn't have a lot of precipitation until April or May. And then it kind of is letting loose for the rest of the spring and the summer. So it's not just the North Pole that's affected, but these El Nino, La Nina events always go back to back.
All right, Richard, thank you. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm just going to say the 35 degrees seems like a lot. It may be that was a spike. It's certainly not an average temperature. The average temperature increase would be a few degrees due to global warming there.
All right, let's go to David in New Paltz. David.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for doing a good job there.
Thank you.
Listen, I'm thinking of getting solar panels for my house, and I don't know exactly how a solar panel turns solar light into electricity. Can anybody tell me that?
Yeah, well, you need a blackboard to explain it well. Over the radio, the solar cell is engineered so that, for one thing, it's a semiconductor, which means that it sort of kind of conducts electricity. It's also engineered so that electricity can really kind of flow only one way. It's a diode. When sunlight is absorbed by the solar cell, it kicks an electron into gives it enough energy that it overcomes that barrier that's built into the cell and makes electricity flow, kind of when you might kind of think that the wrong way, but makes it go kind of the hard way around. When that electron gets enough energy to do that, then it can go through a circuit and light a light bulb, do work, and then come back around to the other side. So it's a matter of the sunlight pushing the electron over that barrier that's built into the cell to generate a voltage.
Can you make the barrier less less resistance?
Actually, you want to
make
it more resistant because what you want is for the electrons to want to get to the other side of the cell but not be able to because there's a barrier there stopping them.
We call that the electromotive force, and that's actually what we store in the battery. It's the work that the electron is doing. We're not actually storing electrons in the battery. We're storing its work.
Yeah, and that barrier is tuned so that part of the talk about the efficiency of cells and kind of theoretical efficiency. For simple solar cells, if the various wavelengths of light have different amounts of energy, if you absorb a blue photon, which has a lot of energy, you use only enough to get it over the barrier, and the rest goes away as heat. So you waste a lot of energy.
Mm.
However, if you make that barrier real low, then you can get lots of photons pushing it over the barrier, but that barrier is so low that the voltage is low and you don't get much work out.
It's like dimes and pennies, right?
Yeah. So it's tuned to just the right spot where you use an optimal amount of photons, but then have the voltage high enough to get useful work out.
And Barbara, you were talking about using a battery system, but can you do direct conversion?
You can, sure.
Sure.
You can use it on the fly, but, you know, then how do you watch TV at night? So have your kids out there shining flashlights. So I went into a bathroom the other day, and I'm fascinated because now the automatic faucet has a PV on the top. It has a little photovoltaic cell on the top. And I'm like, well, it's not in sunlight. And I'm thinking, oh, the lights, duh. It's never going to be dark in here because there's no battery. There's never going to be lights off in the bathroom when I have to wash my hands. The lights will always be on. So in that case, you're getting the direct benefit of the PV acting at that moment to turn on the faucet so I can wash my hands.
Oh, very interesting.
If I turn the lights off or the light blows, everyone's got dirty hands.
David, thank you for that one. 800-348-2551, the number. Okay, we got about a minute and a half before the next break. Let's take another one and see if we can dispense with Michael quickly. Michael in Castleton, you're next.
Hey, Ray, thanks so much. I have a question about condensation trails.
Okay.
High flying commercial aircraft, 35,000 feet. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I have worked decades on becoming an old man, and finally I've realized it. So I can hang out on my porch and I can gaze at the sky. Some days I gaze at the sky, and these high flying commercial planes, 35,000 feet, are leaving contrails. Other days, I gaze at the sky. I see the little silver bullets up in the air flying at the same altitude. They're not leaving contrails. Why is that?
Okay.
This is a good science forum perennial question. We get this a lot.
Yep.
And it has to do with the humidity at that altitude.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? So if you're at the humidity of saturation, then when the hot gases come through that jet
turbine
engine, right, and it expels the water that's a product of combustion. It expands and cools, and if it is now more concentrated in water than than it can handle, it will create the cloud. We'll see the contrail.
Right.
If it's not saturated, then it will dissipate as right now I'm talking into a microphone and there's not a plume of condensate coming out of my mouth because we're not saturated in the room. In the same way that when you take a deep breath in winter and exhale out, you can see it, but in summer you can't. It's the same phenomenon.
Oh, sorry, Michael. We got to take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 800-348-2551. The Science Forum will be back.
From Nine Pin Cider, Albany, hard cider made from local apples. Tasting room featuring New York cider, beer, wine, and spirits Tuesday through Sunday, now available in Massachusetts. NinePinCider.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. Colby Attorney Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services including legal publishing and corporate record searches. ColbyService.com. Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York. Specializing in extra-sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported and domestic specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, and more. WaterwheelVillage.com. And the Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz. An undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies, and performance. NewPaltz.edu/THEATRE.
Vox Pop on WAMC, the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Barbara Bravitz, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander, the scientists today. And this one came in via email at voxpop@wamc.org regarding the radio interference. And this is from Bob in East Nassau. And he writes, I suspect what your caller minutes ago was experiencing was FM skip, and I suspect moving about the room is a red herring. This time of year when I'm listening to a local station, it fades, and then I get some time with the station, for example, from Florida, probably ionospheric heating, maybe could be also similar to tropospheric ducting. Bob, obviously a ham radio operator.
But
well
isn't but that AM skip? That's not FM skip.
No, he's talking about VHF skip, which will happen. Tropospheric ducting will
sure.
do it. But I still think in this case, it is a question of the seasons, and probably he's using a portable antenna, the naturally a weak signal, and it's even weaker at that time. That's what I think.
Okay.
What about you, Jim?
I agree with you, Ray.
All right, good. Then you get to come back. All right, let's go back to let's go to Merle in Argyle. Merle, you're on.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Great.
This has to do with salt and the shelf life of salt and what happens when it breaks down, and can you tell the difference?
Okay.
Well, there's salt out there that's hundreds of millions of years old
salt
and
of the
hasn't
earth.
Broke down
that's
yet.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
Yeah.
Salt's a mineral. And as a mineral, the only real danger with salt is that it gets wet or starts becoming hygroscopic, and then it all sticks together. But salt is salt is salt.
Yeah. Yep. It's on the bottom of the energy train. So.
Yep.
If your box says that there's a shelf life for salt, then all they want to do is have you buy more salt.
You know, a sodium ion and a chloride ion, they meet each other. They're like, yeah, I guess we'll get together. And then they have this weak bond.
Pepper?
What about pepper?
Oh, pepper. Pepper is an organic substance. Yeah. That's actually from a flower, you know, like a blooming flower.
Yep.
And it can decay, absolutely.
Well, or more importantly, the volatile stuff
yeah.
will evaporate away and it
you'll
won't.
You'll have black specks instead of pepper. That's yeah. why people grind their pepper right there. It's not as important to grind your salt at the table, but it is if you're in the highfalutin restaurants. Ground pepper is so much better.
I've never been to one of those. Merle, thank you very much for the call. We go over to Chris in Slingerlands. Chris, you're on.
Thank you. I'm calling because I know that scientists look to nature for solutions, and I know that Velcro is one of those. But I have a dog, and every time I wash a dog bowl, even if it's been dry, it's so slippery when you add water back. And I don't know what it is about dog saliva that makes it so incredibly slippery, but I wonder what that is. But I wonder if that's the kind of thing that scientists look at or have looked at or any comments
wow.
any you have. That's,
yeah.
That's an open-ended question.
I saw the post-it that you were calling, and I started thinking of an episode of Mythbusters. So this is what scientists do when they don't have to pay attention. Yeah. They watch Mythbusters. And they were given the banana peel slip and fall myth. Mm-hmm. And so they, as they always do, they kind of branch out from that myth and look at all the other slippery stuff. And they created a scale of slipperiness, and it's called the static friction scale. That is, if you're standing still and they're slippery underneath you, what are the chances you're going to fall over? And then there's the kinetic friction test, which is you're moving, and that movement continues, and you can't stop.
Okay.
So dog saliva was one of the ones that they tested. It was not the winner chicken dinner, but banana was not as slippery as dog saliva. Dog saliva came above
really?
Banana peel.
So
yes.
there is something to this.
Yes.
Well, there's a.
But there are commercial products that have been created to be slippery. So you've heard of like GAC from like Nickelodeon and stuff. Those actually came out of the petroleum industry. They were used to create slip. Which is a material that you use when drilling to keep friction down when you're boring that metal bore down through rock and soil. So the petroleum industry has created slippery stuff on purpose.
And I've actually had a contract at one point to study how slippery paint can be against ice because we wanted to paint ships so that they could get through the ice easier. And so we developed devices with big pieces of ice and we ran paint across them. So this is a big, big subject.
This is very interesting. It reminds me of that Odd Couple episode with the Felix Unger's barnacle glue. Remember
right,
that?
Yes.
Another great idea.
So like the bloodhounds just have to drip down the side of the ship
and the ice breakers will
move better.
Right.
Fascinating. Doe and Wendell. Doe, you're on.
Hi, I was interested in finding out how vitamin content in food is tested.
Vitamin content in food, how is it tested?
You mean as far
and
as like...
also how- mineral content and cholesterol.
Okay.
Sure. It's very simple. Each one of those is a specific molecule. So vitamin D, there's D1, D2, D3, but say D3, which is the one that most people take as a supplement, that is a specific molecule. It has a specific shape, and it responds in instrumentation a certain way. So if you think of food as one large mixture, we can separate all of the components of the mixture into individual little tiny amounts and then send it into something called a mass spectrometer. And that mass spectrometer will tell us how big it is. And
a master what?
Mass spectrometer. On NCIS, Abby calls it major mass spec.
I got it.
That's, yeah. Okay. So, and it just breaks things into small pieces and then determines what they're made out of. And then there's a little bit of computing or know-how to put those pieces back together again. And then we know what the structure of the molecule is. And we can count how many there are. And that's how we figure out concentration.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Doe, thanks a lot. So this brings another question up that kind of conventional wisdom that I've always heard. It's always better to get your vitamins via food than supplements. But if they're merely molecules in the supplements, what's the difference?
It's how they're made and what the matrix is. So there's a bunch of magic here that we scientists haven't figured out yet. Are there combinations of materials that you have to ingest simultaneously to give you kind of an added bonus effect?
So like vitamin D and calcium.
With E and A together, right?
Yeah.
Like in the same meal.
Magnesium and calcium is a really good example.
Right. And also there's another one. If the D is man-made, how do we know it's clean, right? Nature is an enormously picky synthetic chemist.
But I didn't ask whether it was clean. Let's assume it was clean. Well, and I
but
took
we can't assume it's clean. It's made in a pharmaceutical.
How would my system know if I took vitamin X and I fooled my stomach and I ate some crackers at the same time. So I'm digesting stuff.
Yep.
What's the difference?
None. I'm going to disagree with Barbara here. I agree with there may be something to the matrix effect.
Synergistic effect in things which
allow it to be taken up. But I mean these things are made. They're made much purer than what you could get from nature.
I'm shaking
my head on the radio.
Because I mean nature. You eat a carrot. There's a lot of stuff in there beta carotene.
Right.
Okay.
But there's not the enantiomer of beta carotene there. And enantiomer is the left-handed evil twin of beta carotene in the chemistry world.
Not necessarily. I mean, some of them are evil and you don't want to make those.
That's right.
But if the geologist can add something and get you guys quiet a bit.
Let me clarify. Most of the vitamins are not made in by chemists and reactors. They're made by fermentation.
Oh.
So they're made biologically.
That's
anyway.
True.
Interesting. All right, now go ahead, geologist.
Oh, I was just going to mention that there are different forms of those vitamins.
Yes.
And as such, some forms of vitamin, particularly those in foods, can be more easily assimilated by the body than other forms of the same vitamin. And so in that respect, there may be a difference between the pill you're taking and the food that you're eating.
Let's go to Jason in New Paltz. Jason, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Follow-up to the FM interference issue.
Yeah.
All of the answers are good ones, and the caller mentioned the seasonal aspect of it, and foliage certainly plays into that, but there is a propagation phenomenon that Ray knows about called sporadic E-layer, ionospheric E-layer, propagation, and though that comes and goes, but it peaks in June and again in December. So there's another seasonal aspect. But my question had to do with the energy available for plants in sunlight. A few years ago, I saw a plot that showed wavelength versus energy after the sunlight has filtered through the atmosphere, and there was a gentle peak to the curve in the green-yellow part of the spectrum.
That's correct.
And I thought to myself, why would nature have evolved most plants to reflect those wavelengths because they're green.
Again, it comes back to that same issue of the danger of too much of a good thing. So there's a lot of green and yellow coming out of that we're getting. And even though they're what you might consider mid energy wavelengths, there's a lot of them. So in the same way that a little bit of high energy can do some damage to the inner workings of a cell or a molecule, a lot of medium stuff could do the same thing. So it has go ahead.
Yeah, plus, I mean, the chemistry is really hard for photosynthesis. And the green chlorophyll works pretty darn well.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that there just isn't much that will work better.
It's actually interesting because in aquatic and marine life, we'll have brown algaes that don't absorb in the same locations of what you would see as outwardly green, like green algae. And that's because the light can penetrate deeper into the water column for the stuff that they absorb. So think of it, we all evolved originally from the ocean. So a lot of the selection that happened early on was in this aquatic and marine environment. And so we don't know what role that played as well, but we can speculate that being in water did some of that too.
Jason, great question. Thank you very much. And we go quickly over to Gary in Camden. Gary, you're on.
Hi, guys. I have a variegated maple in my backyard. Do you know what that is?
Yes.
You've heard of them? Okay. Well, my question is, when I first moved in the house 25 years ago, the tree was completely variegated. All the leaves were variegated. Now, the tree is almost all green with just a little bit of variegation on it. And some of the variegated leaves are, you know, like the branch will come out, it'll be variegated. And further down the branch, it'll be solid green. Is this thing going to turn
further down the branch?
A regular maple?
So originally I was saying you have a graft where the graft That's is exactly. taken over the rest of the tree. So we were talking about the hardiness of these ornamentals before and that they're not quite as hardy as the green version. So what they do, especially in northern climates, is they take the rootstock of a more hardy green maple, a greenish type of plant, and then graft the ornamental to the top. But that doesn't explain different leaves on the same branch.
Huh.
Yeah, I was amazed when I saw it. I mean, to the point where I actually had to get on a ladder and climb up and make sure it wasn't a different branch next to it or something.
Yeah.
Gary, I'm going to give you some homework, okay?
Okay.
When you get home, can you take a photo of one of these branches that has the two leaves on it and send it in to Science Forum at WAMC?
Yeah, send it to voxpop@wamc.org. That would be great.
And then we'll take a look at that. I have one other thing that I don't know happens in trees, but when you have these ornamentals, you can infect them with a disease that gives them this variegated look. That's how you do it. You do it with viruses, for example, in tulips, and that's how you get those funky, fancy viruses or tulips. I don't know if they do the same with trees, but that I will investigate on my end if I can see what you're leaves look like.
Or call into the next Vox Pop that has the garden show.
And I was going to say, if you send it into voxpop@wamc.org, Gary, I will also send it to Fred Breglia, who is the arborist on the program. And
right. Fred and I are good friends, too.
Really?
We can have a good science nerdy discussion over it.
I like it. All right, quickly, let's go over. We only have about a minute or two here. Let's go to Tom in Saratoga. Tom, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason I was calling is my wife and I live outside of Saratoga and Wilton, and we've noticed for years when we're out in the yard that there'll be a loud noise like a plane flying overhead in the sky or even a fighter plane, and yet there's no plane visible anywhere. Just kind of wondering what that noise could be.
Hmm. Geology guy?
That's a great question.
It sounds to me like it was a plane.
Yeah.
Yeah, plane doesn't have to be overhead. It could be quite a distance away, and you'll still hear the shockwave as it goes by.
Really? Okay.
I've been up
I'm sorry. It's been going on for years, and I've always been curious, and I was listening to you guys today, and I thought I'd call and ask that question, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I've been up in the Adirondacks camping, and, you know, Plattsburgh's quite a ways away, but when the Plattsburgh Air Force Base was open, I would hear sonic booms, and we were easily 100 miles away.
And maybe it has something to do with the formation or the basin or wherever he is in Saratoga that sort of funnels the sound.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it also has to do with the direction the wind's blowing.
Does it really?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Well, Tom, we're about out of time.
That's interesting.
But thank you for that one. We'll call that one the last one for today. Anything big going on at school? You know, it's summer vacation, but school's coming.
Oh, yes, but it's so different in summer. We just kind of do the things we want to do instead of grading, so which nobody ever wants to do. We just got done sampling the Mohawk River. My colleagues at Riverkeeper and also at SUNY Poly and many of our students got together. We just did sampled the whole river on Monday, and the people who live in upstate New York know that there was a huge flood in like Utica and Herkimer,
yeah.
And the river is still impacted by that flood. It's having a hard time bouncing back.
All right. Well, this was fun, and I want to thank our scientists today, Ed Stander, Barbara Brovitz, and Jim Pickett for being here. Thank you for the great calls and, in general, for listening. Support comes from Whitney's Farm Market and Country Gardens, Cheshire, featuring Pavestone to help construct outdoor living spaces, walkways, retaining walls, pool decks, edgers, fire pits, and more. Whitneysfarm.com. Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. agstewardship.org. And UHY Advisors, accountants and tax advisors to business, government, and not-for-profits, serving the Capital Region for over 50 years. UHY-US.com. Thanks again to the scientists today. Thanks to Deb Malik for answering the phones. Our board was run today, expertly, I might add, by Zach Malloy. And our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we will discuss open fire cooking with a couple of chefs taking part in the fire feast on the farm at Pitney Meadows in Saratoga Springs. I wonder, you think we can get a fire going here in Studio A? What could go wrong? Well, we'll find out tomorrow at 2. Stand by now for news.